Tom Don also suggests that if the government's reading is correct, Congress has unconstitutionally suspended the writ of habeas corpus. We find it unnecessary to reach either of these arguments. Ordinary principles of statutory construction suffice to rebut the government's theory, at least insofar as this case, which was pending at the time the DTA was enacted, is concerned. The government acknowledges that only paragraphs 2 and 3 of subsection E are expressly made applicable to pending cases, but argues that the omission of paragraph 1 from the scope of that express statement is of no moment. This is so, we are told, because Congress's failure to expressly reserve federal court's jurisdiction over pending cases erects a presumption against jurisdiction, and that presumption is rebutted by neither the text nor the legislative history of the DTA. The first part of this argument is not entirely without support in our precedents. We have in the past applied intervening statutes conferring or ousting jurisdiction, whether or not jurisdiction lay when the underlying conduct occurred or when the suit was filed. But the presumption that these cases have applied is more accurately viewed as the non-application of another presumption, viz., the presumption against retroactivity in certain limited circumstances. If a statutory provision would operate retroactively as applied to cases pending at the time the presumption was enacted, then our traditional presumption teaches that it does not govern absent clear congressional intent favoring such a result. We have explained, however, that unlike other intervening changes in the law, a jurisdiction-conferring or jurisdiction-stripping statute usually takes away no substantive right but simply changes the tribunal that is to hear the case. If that is truly all the statute does, no retroactivity problem arises because the change in the law does not impair rights a party possessed when he acted, increase a party's liability for past conduct, or impose new duties with respect to transactions already completed. And if a new rule has no retroactive effect, the presumption against retroactivity will not prevent its application to a case that was already pending when the new rule was enacted. That does not mean, however, that all jurisdiction-stripping provisions, or even all such provisions that truly lack retroactive effect, must apply to cases pending at the time of their enactment. Normal rules of construction, including a contextual reading of the statutory language, may dictate otherwise. A familiar principle of statutory construction, relevant both in Lind versus Murphy and here, is that a negative inference may be drawn from the exclusion of language from one statutory provision that is included in other provisions of the same statute. Where Congress includes particular language in one section of a statute but omits it in another section of the same act, it is generally presumed that Congress acts intentionally and purposely in the disparate inclusion or exclusion. The court in Lind relied on this reasoning to conclude that certain limitations on the availability of habeas relief imposed by the AEDPA applied only to cases filed after that statute's effective date. Congress's failure to identify the temporal reach of those limitations, which governed non-capital cases, stood in contrast to its express command in the same legislation that new rules governing habeas petitions in capital cases apply to cases pending on or after the date of enactment. That contrast, combined with the fact that the amendments at issue affected substantive entitlement to relief, warranted drawing a negative inference. A like inference follows a fortiori from Lind in this case. If Congress was reasonably concerned to ensure that sections 1005E2 and 3 be applied to pending cases, it should have been just as concerned about section 1005E1, unless it had the different intent that the latter section not be applied to the general run of pending cases. If anything, the evidence of deliberate omission is stronger here than it was in Lind. In Lind, the provisions to be contrasted had been drafted separately but were later joined together and considered simultaneously when the language raising the implication was inserted. We observed that Congress's tandem review and approval of the two sets of provisions strengthened the presumption that the relevant omission was deliberate. Here, Congress not only considered the respective temporal reaches of paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 of subsection E together at every stage, but omitted paragraph 1 from its directive that paragraphs 2 and 3 apply to pending cases only after having rejected earlier proposed versions of the statute that would have included what is now paragraph 1 within the scope of that directive. Congress's rejection of the very language that would have achieved the result the government urges here weighs heavily against the government's interpretation. The government nonetheless offers two reasons why, in its view, no negative inference may be drawn in favor of jurisdiction. First, it asserts that Lind is inapposite because Section 1005(e)(1) and H1 remove jurisdiction, while Section 1005(e)(2), (3), and H2 create an exclusive review mechanism and define the nature of that review. Because the provisions being contrasted address wholly distinct subject matters, the government argues, Congress's different treatment of them is of no significance. This argument must fail because it rests on a false distinction between the jurisdictional nature of subsection E1 and the procedural character of subsections E2 and E3. In truth, all three provisions govern jurisdiction over detainees' claims. Subsection E1 addresses jurisdiction in habeas cases and other actions relating to any aspect of the detention, while subsections E2 and 3 vest exclusive but limited jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit to review final decisions of CSRTs and military commissions. That subsection E1 strips jurisdiction while subsections E2 and E3 restore it in limited form is hardly a distinction upon which a negative inference must founder. Justice Scalia, in arguing to the contrary, maintains that Congress had ample reason to provide explicitly for application of subsections E2 and E3 to pending cases because jurisdiction-stripping provisions like subsection E1 have been treated differently under our retroactivity jurisprudence than jurisdiction-conferring ones like subsections E2 and E3. That theory is insupportable. Assuming, arguendo, that subsections E2 and E3 confer new jurisdiction in the D.C. Circuit, where there was none before, and that our precedents can be read to strongly indicate that jurisdiction-creating statutes raise special retroactivity concerns not also raised by jurisdiction-stripping statutes, subsections E2 and E3 confer jurisdiction in a manner that cannot conceivably give rise to retroactivity questions under our precedents. The provisions impose no additional liability or obligation on any private party or even on the United States, unless one counts the burden of litigating an appeal, a burden not a single one of our cases suggests triggers retroactivity concerns. Moreover, it strains credulity to suggest that the desire to reinforce the application of subsections E2 and E3 to pending cases drove Congress to exclude subsection E1 from section 1005H2. The government's second objection is that applying subsections E2 and E3, but not E1, to pending cases produces an absurd result because it grants, albeit only temporarily, dual jurisdiction over detainees' cases in circumstances where the statute plainly envisions that the District of Columbia Circuit will have exclusive and immediate jurisdiction over such cases. But the premise here is faulty. Subsections E2 and E3 grant jurisdiction only over actions to determine the validity of any final decision of a CSRT or commission. Because Hamdan, at least, is not contesting any final decision of the CSRT or military commission, his action does not fall within the scope of subsection E2 or E3. There is, then, no absurdity. The government's more general suggestion that Congress can have had no good reason for preserving habeas jurisdiction over cases that had been brought by detainees prior to the enactment of the DTA not only is belied by the legislative history, but is otherwise without merit. There is nothing absurd about a scheme under which pending habeas actions, particularly those like this one that challenge the very legitimacy of the tribunal whose judgments Congress would like to have reviewed, are preserved, and more routine challenges to final decisions rendered by those tribunals are carefully channeled to a particular court and through a particular lens of review. Finally, we cannot leave unaddressed Justice Scalia's contentions that the meaning of Section 1005(e)(1) is entirely clear and that the plain import of a statute repealing jurisdiction is to eliminate the power to consider and render judgment in an already pending case no less than in a case yet to be filed. Only by treating the Bruner rule as an inflexible trump, a thing it has never been, and ignoring both the rest of Section 1005's text and its drafting history, can one conclude as much. Congress here expressly provided that subsections E2 and E3 applied to pending cases. It chose not to so provide after having been presented with the option for subsection E1. The omission is an integral part of the statutory scheme that muddies whatever plain meaning may be discerned from blinkered study of subsection E1 alone. The dissent's speculation about what Congress might have intended by the omission not only is counterfactual, but rests on both a misconstruction of the DTA and an erroneous view of our precedents. For these reasons, we deny the government's motion to dismiss. Part 3. Relying on our decision in Councilman, the government argues that even if we have statutory jurisdiction, we should apply the judge-made rule that civilian courts should await the outcome of an ongoing military proceeding before entertaining an attack on those proceedings. Like the District Court and the Court of Appeals before us, we reject this argument. In Councilman, an Army officer on active duty was referred to a court-martial for trial on charges that he had violated the UCMJ by selling, transferring, and possessing marijuana. Objecting that the alleged offenses were not service-connected, the officer filed suit in the Federal District Court to enjoin the proceedings. He neither questioned the lawfulness of courts-martial or their procedures, nor disputed that, as a serviceman, he was subject to court-martial jurisdiction. His sole argument was that the subject matter of his case did not fall within the scope of the court-martial authority. The District Court granted his request for injunctive relief, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. We granted certiorari and reversed. We did not reach the merits of whether the marijuana charges were sufficiently service-connected to place them within the subject matter jurisdiction of a court-martial. Instead, we concluded that, as a matter of comity, federal courts should normally abstain from intervening in pending court-martial proceedings against members of the armed forces, and further, that there was nothing in the particular circumstances of the officer's case to displace that general rule. Councilman identifies two considerations of comity that together favor abstention pending completion of ongoing court-martial proceedings against service personnel. First, military discipline, and therefore the efficient operation of the armed forces, are best served if the military justice system acts without regular interference from civilian courts. Second, federal courts should respect the balance that Congress struck between military preparedness and fairness to individual service members when it created an integrated system of military courts and review procedures, a critical element of which is the Court of Military Appeals, consisting of civilian judges completely removed from all military influence or persuasion. Just as abstention in the face of an ongoing state criminal proceeding is justified by our expectation that state courts will enforce federal rights, so abstention in the face of ongoing court-martial proceedings is justified by our expectation that the military court system established by Congress, with its substantial procedural protections and provision for appellate review by independent civilian judges, will vindicate servicemen's constitutional rights. The same cannot be said here. Indeed, neither of the comity considerations identified in Councilman weighs in favor of abstention in this case. First, Hamdan is not a member of our nation's armed forces, so concerns about military discipline do not apply. Second, the tribunal convened to try Hamdan is not part of the integrated system of military courts, complete with independent review panels, that Congress has established. Unlike the officer and councilman, Hamdan has no right to appeal any conviction to the civilian judges of the Court of Military Appeals, now called the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Instead, under Department of Defense Military Commission's Order No. 1, which was issued by the President on March 21, 2002, and amended most recently on August 31, 2005, and which governs the procedures for Hamdan's commission, any conviction would be reviewed by a panel consisting of three military officers designated by the Secretary of Defense. Commission Order No. 1 provides that appeal of a review panel's decision may be had only to the Secretary of Defense himself, and then, finally, to the President. We have no doubt that the various individuals assigned review power under Commission Order No. 1 would strive to act impartially and ensure that Hamdan receive all protections to which he is entitled. Nonetheless, these review bodies clearly lack the structural insulation from military influence that characterizes the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and thus bear insufficient conceptual similarity to state courts to warrant invocation of abstention principles. In sum, neither of the two comity considerations underlying our decision to abstain in Councilman applies to the circumstances of this case. Instead, this court's decision in Quirin is the most relevant precedent. In Quirin, 7 German saboteurs were captured upon arrival by submarine in New York and Florida. The president convened a military commission to try the saboteurs, who then filed habeas corpus petitions in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, challenging their trial by commission. We granted the saboteurs petition for certiorari to the Court of Appeals before judgment. Far from abstaining pending the conclusion of military proceedings, which were ongoing, we convened a special term to hear the case and expedited our review. That course of action was warranted, we explained, in view of the public importance of the questions raised by the cases and of the duty which rests on the courts in time of war as well as in time of peace to preserve unimpaired the constitutional safeguards of civil liberty, and because, in our opinion, the public interest required that we consider and decide those questions without any avoidable delay.